FS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Financial Sense Wealth Management President, Jim Poplava.
Well, right now, the U.S. is experiencing its longest economic expansion in history. The stock market is at record levels. Unemployment rates are the lowest they've been in half a century. With all this good news, it would seem hard to believe that a possible crisis lies directly in front of us. And that's the topic. Joining me on the program is author James Rickard. His latest book, The Aftermath, Seven Secrets of Wealth Preservation in the Coming Chaos. Jim, you've written three previous books. This is your fourth. Could you briefly capsulize your previous books? And is this the culmination of your thesis that you think a major crisis lies directly in front of us?
Sure. And that's, first of all, that's exactly right. The new book, Aftermath, is volume four of what I call the International Monetary Quartet. So the other volumes, first was my book, Currency Wars, which came out in 2011. Then The Death of Money, which came out in 2014. The Road to Ruin came out in 2016. And now in 2019, we have Aftermath. By the way, I wrote another book along the way. It's not part of the quartet formally. It's a little bit more of a manifesto. It's called The New Case for Gold. That also came out in 2016. But I wrote that for a separate purpose. I just got tired of hearing, you know, you can have gold or not have gold. That's up to you. I'm not a gold dealer. I do recommend it. But, you know, whether you buy it or not is kind of up to you. But I just got tired of all the cliche anti-gold statements that economists make. And I said, I just have to knock them all down because they were all, you know, demonstrably, empirically, historically false. So I just kind of wanted to get that all in one book. And so that's out there. But getting back to the quartet, yeah, this is volume four. I'm sure I'll write other books. In fact, I have a couple of book projects in the works. But this is it. I almost got to the point where there's nothing left to say. I've outlined the system. I've written about the history. I've pointed to the weaknesses. I've pointed to the right models for thinking about it. And they're not the ones that central banks use, and they're not the ones that Wall Street uses. But they're very good, well-founded scientific models using complexity theory, behavioral economics, Bayesian statistics, history, and other inputs that most people don't use, or actually very few people use at all. So as I say, I'll write other books, but these four books go together. They can be read individually, and people have their favorites, and that's fine. I'm always very appreciative of that. But what we do here is we go through, parts of it go back to Charlemagne. Charlemagne invented quantitative easing in the 9th century when he switched from a gold standard to a silver standard because there was a lot more silver around. So it kind of goes to the saying, there's nothing new under the sun. But if you take an historical perspective, study the Great Depression, study the Weimar hyperinflation, the national Chinese hyperinflation in 1949 and many other instances, it really helps in understanding what's going on today. And the other thing people ask is, well, okay, the title of your new book is Aftermath, the aftermath of what? And there I say there has two meanings. One is we're in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. Yeah, technically, you know, that the expansion has been going on since June 2009. The crisis is long over in the minds of a lot of people, but I make the point that the crisis had causes and none of the problems have been cured. They've been alleviated, if you will, with money printing and zero interest rates and currency swaps and a lot of other, you know, guarantees behind the scenes, but they haven't been solved and they will come back on an even larger, more dangerous scale, and investors can prepare for that now. And then the second meaning is when this new crisis comes, which it will, there'll be an aftermath of that. And what will that look like? And I make the point that it won't look like the last 10 years. It'll actually maybe look more like something, 1910 or even the late 19th century, where you have maybe a simple, more agrarian, less complicated, less automated society. That's a major change, but it's not too soon to start thinking about that.
Yeah, I want to get into it as we get into your book, because this technological society that's very complex that we live in today, that would be hard for some people to imagine. I want to talk about something that you write about in your book, and that's deflation being a central bank's worst nightmare. We know that central banks have been trying to target 2% inflation. And as you write in your book, price deflation actually produces gains for citizens in the form of lower prices. One of the problems government has with that, they can't tax that.
That's exactly right. So so let's just take it from the point of view of an everyday citizen. So let's say you make $100,000. Just pick a number. It could be any number. But say you make $100,000. And you go in and you ask your boss for a raise. And your boss says, are you crazy? You're lucky I don't fire you. You know, we're not making any money. Get out of here. And so that's one, you know, one scenario. If you did get a 10% raise, let's say the boss says, okay, I'll give you a raise from $100,000 to $10,000. Or so to $110,000, what happens? Well, the government takes half, you know, more or less, when you get into state and local governments and all the rest. So you get a $10,000 raise, but your standard of living only went up by $5,000, assuming prices are constant, because the government took half in taxes. So now let's take the other scenario. Yes, for the raise, you don't get it. So you're still making $100,000, but prices drop 10%. Well, your standard of living just went up 10%. If, you know, gas at the pump and food in the store and a new car and airline tickets or all the, you know, healthcare, all the day-to-day expenses, if they went down 10% and you're making the same amount of money, your standard of living just went up 10% because everything's cheaper, with one difference, which is the government doesn't know how to tax that. They know how to tax the raise. If you give me $10,000 more, the government takes half. But if you give me a $10,000 price cut, so I'm better off, they don't know how to tax the price cut. So that's the first problem government has with it, which is individuals are better off in a deflationary environment just because prices are lower, but the government can't tax it. But there's another problem that central banks have with deflation, which is deflation increases the real value of debt. So, because debt is nominal. So if I owe you $100, it's an interesting question whether it's worth more or less in real terms, but the contract is for $100. I owe you $100. Well, if you have inflation and the purchasing power of the $100 is cut to $80, you've just made my life easier. I can pay you back the $100, but it really, in real terms, it's only $80 because the money's not worth as much. But in deflation, the opposite is true. I owe you $100, but the value of the money goes up. That's what deflation is. The value of money goes up. Well, now I'm paying you back the $100, but it feels like $120 because the real value of the money went up. So what happens is that initially, at least, creditors win and debtors lose. This is why debtors hate deflation. They love inflation, but they hate deflation. This was a big political issue in the United States in the 1890s as we moved to something more like a solid gold standard. At the time, there were farmers and miners and others who had a lot of debt, and the real value of that debt was going up. And they were complaining to their members of Congress. Some were going bankrupt, but others were saying, you know, we need inflation. That was what the William Jennings Bryan campaign was all about in 1896. But so that starts out as a problem for debtors. But pretty quickly, the debtors default. So where does the loss fall? It falls on the banks. And what does that do? It puts the banks in distress. And what's the Fed's job? The Fed's job is to bail out the banks. Everyone thinks the Fed's job is to help the economy and lower unemployment. Yeah, they try to do that. They say they do, but that's all nonsense. Their real job is to prop up the banking system. That's why the Fed was created. So the Fed doesn't like deflation, and the government doesn't like deflation for two reasons. One, it increases people's welfare, but the government can't tax it. And two, it increases the real value of debt and causes defaults and puts the banking system in distress. So for those reasons, the Fed will oppose deflation with everything at their disposal. Now, if you ask me to describe the world absent central bank intervention, there's no question that we live in a deflationary world. This is a debate I have with Harry Dent all the time, because Harry says, you know, the world's deflationary. And he makes a good case because of demographics and technology and other headwinds to growth. But then I say, Harry, I agree with everything you said, except for one thing, which is central banks won't allow deflation. You're ignoring the fact that there's central bank intervention. So the world the world does want to deflate. The reasons for that are demographic. Japan's population is declining. Russia's population is declining. China's population is flatlining. Europe is not at a replacement level for births per the number of women of childbearing age. The U.S. was growing slightly, but mainly because of immigration and Trump's shutting off the immigration pipeline. So now the U.S. is going to start to look more like Europe. And if you take the view that, and it's not a view, it's just an economic fact that, you know, growth can be boiled down to two things. I mean, there are kinds of formulas and multi-factor analysis you can use, but the simplest way to think about growth is population plus productivity. How many people are working and how productive are they? Well, productivity is declining for reasons economists don't entirely understand, but population is declining too. So you're not going to have any growth. And if you don't have growth, you can't pay the debt. So central banks must have inflation to reduce the real value of the debt. They cannot tolerate deflation because it increases the real value of the debt. This makes forecasting the Fed actually very easy. If you think about the real reasons for doing what they're doing, the forecasting becomes simple.
I want to talk about something that made the headlines recently. You address it in your book, and it's going to be part of this crisis you see unfolding. Jim, recently the government reported $1 trillion deficit, and the fiscal year will end this month, but this was last month. The CBO reports $1 trillion deficits going forward. Now, what makes this unusual, we had $1 trillion deficits during the financial crisis, but we were in a deep recession, we were in a bear market. We have $1 trillion deficits now, the economy is growing, the unemployment rate is the lowest it's been. And it's, as you point out, the only way that you can get rid of an issue like this is either to print it, default it. But modern monetary theory says, hey, we don't need to worry about it. I mean, I don't see politicians, this includes the president, and either party talking about this as an issue. It's not an issue in the political campaign. And people point out to Japan's debt to GDP ratio is bigger than ours. So we don't have anything to worry about that. I think you would take umbrage with that.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. It's actually kind of a five-part question, which is okay. I love those. Let me unpack it a little bit. The first, and I cover this in chapter 2 and chapter 5 of my book. Chapter 2 does a deep dive on the history of debt in the United States, and chapter 5 takes on modern monetary theory head on. So let's start with the debt. There's a kind of a notion out there that, you know, George Washington gets sworn in 1789, and there's no debt, and then there's some debt, and then the debt goes up and up and up, and you get to today with President Trump, and we have a $23 trillion national debt, and it just went up the whole time. That narrative is false. That's not what happened. First of all, George Washington had debt before we had a country. We had a national debt before we had a nation, because it was Revolutionary War debt that was unpaid, and this was Alexander Hamilton's great insight, because Washington talked to the Congress, said, what do we do about this debt? And the Congress said, well, that's easy. Just don't pay it. You know, it's the American way, just default. And Hamilton said, no, let's borrow more money, pay off the old debt, and then we can borrow more money in the future and pay off the new debt and just keep rolling it over. And that was the invention of the government bond market. And it's been going strong for, you know, kind of upwards of 230 years at this point. But Hamilton's insight was, if you have a growing economy, you can support more debt, use it to pay off the old debt, and just keep rolling it over and just keep going. And Hamilton was right about that. But there was an important caveat, which is you have to have a growing economy. So the history of debt is actually, it's not a straight line up. It was cyclical. The debt, and I use the debt to GDP ratio because that kind of helps to smooth, you know, get through price adjustments, inflation, deflation, all that. So you just use nominal debt to nominal GDP. But the point being, it would go up in times of war, such as the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War of 1848, certainly the Civil War in the early 1860s. But it would go down in times of peace. A good example of that was Andrew Jackson. When Jackson left office in early 1837, there was no national debt. Jackson was the last president to wipe out the national debt. He also wiped out the central bank at the time. So Jackson's legacy was no debt, no central bank. And of course, the U.S. had a great period of prosperity based on those two things. So the U.S. debt to GDP is not a straight line. It's more of a sine wave. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down based on war and peace. Up in times of war, down in times of peace. And that was considered prudent. You would reduce the debt to GDP ratio in prosperous, peaceful times so that you had dry powder in case you had to borrow to fight a war. Now, that was true. Everything I just described was true up until around the year 2000, at the end of the Clinton administration. Just to kind of make that point, the highest debt to GDP ratio in U.S. history was at the end of World War II. It was 120% debt to GDP. But I make the point that, well, at least we won the war and we got something for the money. We were global military and economic hegemon. But then what happened next was interesting. Over a 35-year period, from 1945 to 1980, the U.S. reduced the debt to GDP ratio from 120% to 30%. And that was a bipartisan effort. It was Republicans and Democrats working together. It was never a partisan issue. So you had Republicans like Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, and you had Democrats like Harry Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, and Jimmy Carter, all working, and I left out Gerald Ford on the Republican side, but they worked together. And that debt came down steadily until when Reagan came in, it was only 30%. Now, Reagan popped it up to 50%. Reagan, the idea that he was a conservative with money is not true. He was kind of almost the last of the big spenders, but he was starting on a very low base and took it up to 50%, which is not quite the red zone. George H.W. Bush and Clinton worked together to keep it under control. They didn't lower it a lot, a little bit, but not a lot, but at least they kept a lid on it. Where everything I just described, where it ran off the rails was beginning with George W. Bush. So when Bill Clinton left office, the national debt was $5 trillion and the debt to GDP ratio was around 60%, which is high, but not in the red zone. Bush doubled it from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. But then Obama doubled it again from a higher base from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. And then Trump has piled on a couple of trillion on top of that. So where this whole thesis that the debt to GDP ratio goes up and down and up and down became false in 2000, it has just gone straight up since then. It is now at the highest level since World War II, except we haven't won any wars. We're not nearly in the position on a relative basis we were in 1945. And based on CBO projections, which I think are conservative, I expect it will be worse than what the CBO is saying, that debt to GDP ratio is going to keep going up. But there's another thing that has taken place, which is we crossed the 90% threshold. Why is 90% significant? There's a huge body of research, most of it led by Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, two professors at Harvard, who demonstrate very persuasively with lots of empirical evidence that once you get past 90%, you can't grow your way out of the debt. Because the Keynesian theory was, well, it's okay to borrow because I borrow a dollar, spend a dollar, and I get $1.25 of growth. Or I borrow a dollar, spend a dollar, and I get $1.50 of growth. That's the famous Keynesian multiplier. But the Keynesian multiplier is not a general theory. It turns out to be a special theory. It only works in certain circumstances. And what Reinhart and Rogoff point out is once you get past 90%, you borrow a dollar, you spend a dollar, and you get 90 cents of growth. You don't even get a dollar. You're now getting negative returns. What does that mean? It means that your debt's growing faster than your economy. Your debt's growing faster than the economy's growing. That GDP, debt to GDP ratio is getting worse, and there is no way out. No way out. Except inflation. And so do we have any inflation today? No. Any on the immediate horizon? No. But it must come. It has to come because it's the only way out other than out of that debt to GDP ratio. There are two other ways out, but they don't apply. One is growth, but I already said because of the natural deflationary state of the world and the high debt to GDP ratio, growth has been snuffed out. And the other way is default, but there's no reason for the U.S. to default because the debt's in dollars and we can print the dollars. The third way out and the way that's going to happen is inflation.
I want to talk about something related to this and maybe where we're heading. The problem, when you have an issue that we should be dealing with, if you take a look at, you write in your book, liberal economics that is taught in school. In fact, it's taught to anybody who works on Wall Street that gets a CFA. The real goal is global governance and taxation. And is this related to the issue that is up in this presidential campaign about open borders?
Well, open borders are on the list. So what is the elite agenda? And it's not some like deep, dark secret society. We actually know who they are. I could tell you who the elites are. It's Augustine Carstens and Mark Carney and Christine Lagarde and a lot of others. So we know who they are. And they tell you what they're going to do. And this is interesting because take the IMF, for example. I call them transparently non-transparent. And what I mean by that is they actually tell you what they're doing, but it's written in such jargon and in equations, and it's so technical, it's really only understood by the people who are in on the deal. So yeah, if you work at the IMF, you get it. There are a few academics and a few outside experts and a club of central bankers, they get it. But the everyday citizen, even well-informed people, well-educated people don't understand it because it's almost like a foreign language. You know, I happen to be one of the few people, I mean, I was trained in this. I went to the School of Advanced International Studies where I did my graduate work in economics. Well, that's boot camp for the IMF. I mean, Tim Geithner went there. You know, a lot of people who ended up running a lot of multilateral institutions, you know, went to the same school. But that's where, again, just think of it, it's down in Washington, part of Johns Hopkins University. But that's boot camp for the IMF. Well, that's where I got my training. So I understand all this. But I happen not to be in that particular mindset. Sometimes I feel, Jim, I feel like a translator. I go into the, like Margaret Mead or something, I go into the jungle and I get all the code and I come back and give it to people in plain language. So I can read these papers and follow these, follow the math and follow the treatments and understand it, but I don't agree with it at all. And I consider it my role or duty or, you know, as a writer or as an analyst or whatever, just to kind of explain it to people. So there's no question the agenda is world governance, world money, and world taxation. That's easy. There's the expression BEPS, B-E-P-S. What the heck is that? Well, it stands for base erosion and profit shifting, meaning why is Apple in Ireland? Why is Google in the Cayman Islands? Well, they're obviously doing this to avoid taxes. That's called base shifting, meaning move your taxable base someplace where you don't have to pay much tax. Well, one country can't beat that because it's, you know, one country versus another country. They have tax treaties, accounting conventions, et cetera. It's really going to take all the major economies in the world banding together to say, you can run, but you can't hide. We don't care where you go. We're going to tax you on a global basis, and then we'll divide it among ourselves. We'll, you know, divvy up the spoils, if you will. Well, that's a live project. The BEPS is a live project being run by the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, based in Paris. You know, open borders, I don't think I need to say a lot about that. You know, why have maybe perhaps a million Syrians flooded into Germany? Well, cheap labor for an export-driven economy. It's not a racial thing. It's not a bias. It's just an economic fact. You think about climate change. Well, if you want global solutions, like global governance, global taxation, the things we talked about, if you want global solutions, you need a global problem. Because if a problem is can be defined as purely confined to one country, then the country say, well, you know, we'll have our own policy. We'll have our own tax policy, our own fiscal policy, our own regulatory policy, as the case may be. Well, if you want a global solution, you need a global problem. Well, climate change is perfect for that because if there is climate change, and the answer is there isn't much, that does not respect borders. So that's one reason you see all the elites and all the media, and you got the 16-year-old Greta sailed across the Atlantic in a sailboat. I mean, yeah, right. She's a paid propagandist for the global climate alarmist movement, and she testified before Congress recently. But it's all designed to create a problem that can't be solved by one country, and therefore you need these global solutions. So that's the agenda. How do you fight back? If you want to say America first, which I'm an American, so I'm okay with that. But, you know, if you're a German, then Germany first. If you're a Japanese, Japan first. And, you know, respect your own country and be loyal to your country. If that's your goal, how do you fight back against this globalist approach? Well, the first way is to understand it, to get a good education, use critical thinking, use good analytical methods and good science, and just push back. People are surprised to learn that there was a mild global warming trend in the 90s that ended in 1995. Sea levels, are they rising? Yeah, about 7 inches a year. Well, since the Ice Age, sea levels rose 400 feet. feet, and people are doing just fine. So 7 inches in 100 – I might have misspoke. I might have said 7 inches a year. I meant to say 7 inches in 100 years. That's the level they can detect, and it's barely detectable. You know, I'm not too worried about 7 inches in 100 years, and it's probably going to reverse. So the climate change science says there isn't much climate change. It's not caused by CO2, but try telling that to anyone who's drunk the Kool-Aid, so to speak. But that's the fight you have to have. It has to be educational. It has to be science-based. It has to be fact-based. You can't be intimidated by the critics who want to, you know, call you names and so forth. And you just have to plug away. And I see some of that happening. But that's what it's going to take to avoid global governance.
I want to just stay there just for a minute because, you know, I think it was 2003 when Al Gore came out with his book, Inconvenient Truth, or the movie. The world was going to end in 10 years. AOC just recently came out, and I think she said it's going to end in 12 years. But it's very alarmist. I mean, if you don't really understand this and you hear people on TV telling you the world's going to end in 10, 12 years, I mean, that's a frightening fact for people if you don't really understand what they're really trying to project.
Well, that's right. My conclusion is the less scientific you are, the more alarmist you need to be, because you're just trying to scare people. You're not trying to educate people. Yeah, right. I mean, Gore, yeah, whether it came out 2003, I think it's about right. He said, you know, in 10 years, you know, the New York City subway system would be inundated by rising sea levels. He had a picture of the last polar bear on a little hunk of ice, but it was melting. And so the polar bears were going to go extinct. And, you know, tropical storms would be, you know, category 6. They'd be worse than ever. And they'd be coming every 5 minutes. And, you know, I'm overstating a little bit, but that's basically what Gore was saying. Two answers to that. Number one, here's some facts. The polar bear populations are thriving. They don't know what to do with all the polar bears. And actually, polar bears are getting fat. They have too much food. So that's just a fact. Tropical storms, well, guess what? The worst decade for tropical storms in terms of intensity and the things people care about, the 1940s, long before we had anywhere near the levels of CO2 we have today. You talk to a real scientist, now I'm talking about a PhD climatologist, PhD physicist, geologist, people who actually know what they're talking about. But I've read these papers and read books and gone to these primary sources. They would say that they can't actually figure out what CO2 does. It's a trace gas. It's 0.3% of what's in the atmosphere. It doesn't cause warming. It can be caused by warming. In other words, if you actually have a warming trend, this can cause more CO2 to be released. But it's like when you say CO2 causes climate change, there is a correlation, but the causation is backwards in terms of what the climate change people say. In other words, it's like saying umbrellas cause rain. I mean, there's a very high correlation between rain and umbrellas, but umbrellas don't cause rain. Rain causes people to use umbrellas. So by the same token, CO2 does not cause global warming, but it might be true that global warming causes more CO2 to be released. So there's your correlation, but Gore had the causation exactly backwards. When you dig into the science, CO2 is not the problem. Global warming, as I say, that slight trend stopped, you know, over 20 years ago. Sea levels are not rising. Polar bears are thriving. All those predictions are wrong. But, you know, Jim, you pointed out to what Gore was saying in the early 2000s, and you're right. But you can go back to the 1970s. I remember picking up Time magazine in the 1970s and reading about the coming ice age, the global cooling. And I also remember the population bomb. We'd all be resorting to cannibalism by the 1980s because the population was growing too fast for the food supply, et cetera, et cetera. So these predictions are always wrong. They were wrong in Al Gore's hands, and AOC is wrong also. But notice they make predictions and create anxiety based on things that are non-falsifiable. And what I mean by that, that's a scientific test. So the way science works, you do some work, you do some research, you do some experiments, you develop a hypothesis, and you put it out there. You can never prove a hypothesis. You can never prove a theory. What you can do is disprove it. And that's how science works. Like I put out a hypothesis, and then you do an experiment. You say, Jim, my experiment shows that your hypothesis is wrong. And I say, thank you very much. I'll abandon it. I'll work on a new one. That's how real science works. But what if I put out something that you cannot falsify? There's no experiment that you can conduct to show I'm wrong. That's what the climate change alarmists do. If you say global warming and I show data that shows that, no, there is no global warming, I've just falsified your thesis. But what they say is they got rid of global warming years ago. They say climate change. Well, yeah, the climate changes. I used to live on, I lived for a decade on Long Island Sound. a really nice body of water. We can, you know, water ski and fish and sail and do all kinds of things. Well, guess what? It used to be a glacier. Long Island Sound was the pretty much the southernmost extent of glaciation in the last ice age. So, you know, it used to be a glacier. Now it's a nice body of water. Well, that's climate change. But it took 10,000 years. So I don't deny that the climate changes. Of course it changes. The question is, in what way, how fast, and why? And when you get to the why part, is it anything that humans can actually do anything about? Well, the answer is they're not sure why, but the best science says it has to do with solar cycles, volcanoes, seismic movements, things of that sort, that climate changes slowly and over long periods of time. And it's pure arrogance and ignorance to think that humans can do much about it. That's real climate change. The stuff you hear about politically is nonsense, but it has an agenda.
I want to go on to, you were an advisor on international economics and financial threats to the Department of Defense. Can you tell us your role? What was the purpose? In other words, why was the government or Department of Defense studying these kind of financial threats?
Well, I did a lot for the Department of Defense, but I also work mainly in the intelligence community, the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence. And I was originally tapped after 9/11 because there was insider trading ahead of 9/11. That's not, you know, a conspiracy theory or anything of the kind. It's very well documented. On the last two trading days before 9/11, the put buying on United Airlines and American Airlines was 286 times the average daily volume. So it's like somebody who goes in every day and buys a Big Mac for lunch, and one day they order 286 Big Macs. Well, you know something's up. That's not the normal lunch, in other words. So, and there's a lot of other evidence. So there was insider trading before 9/11. And so what the CIA said is, well, we're not a law enforcement agency. That's up to the FBI and the SEC. But we are an intelligence agency, and our job is to look forward. And if there was insider trading before 9/11, which there was, the question is, well, will there be another spectacular attack? Would there be insider trading again? Could you identify it, trace it to the source, get a FISA warrant, break down the door, and stop the attack? That was a strategic study, and I was a co-director of that. And basically, the answer to all the questions was yes. And we need to be alert to another attack. There would be insider trading. You could find it. You could trace it. You could potentially stop the attack. And then from there, we wrapped up the strategic study and said, well, can you build a machine that could actually spot it? And we did. This is all called Project Prophecy. And with collaborators, we built an automated system that was geared to spotting insider trading. And it worked. It actually worked better than we expected. We told the agency, look, for the budget we have, you know, you're going to get a go-kart. But if you like the go-kart, we can turn that into a Rolls-Royce. But for the go-kart budget, it actually turned out to be something more like a Rolls-Royce. It worked extremely well. Now, bearing in mind that a lot of the hits, we had a, you know, typical green, yellow, red system. And when you get a red light, red flashing light, a lot of those were not terror attacks. They were just good old-fashioned sleazeballs, you know, insider traders, people, you know, lawyers or directors or whoever. And we spotted that, and we were giving some referrals to the SEC, but then we got our wrist slapped because, again, the CIA is not a law enforcement agency. So we started what we called the catch and release program, which was we would spot the insider traders, but if there was no reason to believe it was terror, we just let it go. But there was one in August 2006 where we got a bright red on American Airlines a few days before MI5 and New Scotland Yard rounded up a large group of terrorists who were, this was the liquid bomb plot, you may recall. This is why you can't bring your water on a plane to this day, because they were going to take chemicals to make a bomb in different water bottles or containers and then mix them on the plane and blow up the plane. But they were going to do it to 10 planes, try to kill 3,000, mostly Americans in midair because they were targeting American Airlines and a few others. Well, we got a bright red on that. So this system works. But then my work branched out, and I was the co-creator and facilitator of the first ever financial war game. And this was sponsored by the Pentagon. We did it at the Top Secret Applied Physics Laboratory in March 2009. I wrote about that in my first book, Currency Wars. What's interesting is that the intelligence community kind of lost its way. they were very supportive and very interested, and they got the answers to the questions, but they sort of put it on the shelf. But the military was much more interested, and I always make the point that, you know, civilians can screw up pretty badly, but when things get really bad, the call goes to the military to solve the problem. So they end up being on the front lines, including financial war, whether they like it or not. And they were always very very supportive of our work. But today is a good example of what's going on. You know, recently, of course, Iran launched a drone and cruise missile attack on the largest energy oil processing facilities in Saudi Arabia, took 5% of global output offline overnight. And everyone was waiting for Trump to, you know, strike back, or Trump or U.S. and the Saudis together attack some Iranian facilities. And that may happen. Yeah, it hasn't happened as of today, but it may happen. But people really miss the point. They go, well, really, Trump's showing a lot of restraint. No, he didn't. He called Secretary Mnuchin and dialed up the financial sanctions on Iran. And what people don't understand is that we are in a full-scale war with Iran today and have been for 2 years. But it's not a kinetic war, it's except on their side. On our side, it's a financial war. And so people need to stop thinking about financial sanctions as, you know, an extension of trade policy. This is warfare. It just is a different form. There's kinetic war. That's things that blow up and explode, sure. But there's cyber war. There's financial war. And then there's cyber financial war, where you use the cyber techniques, hacking, et cetera, to cause economic damage through capital markets and the banking system. So the fact that Iran is firing cruise missiles at Saudi Arabia, seizing tankers in international waters, and, you know, doing other fairly extreme things tells me that we're winning the financial war. They're feeling the heat. The maximum pressure campaign engineered by Trump and Mnuchin and Pompeo and others is working, and we may be getting close to regime change without firing a shot. So it's important to understand that financial war is not a sideshow. It may actually be the main event. And that's important for investors to understand, because all of a sudden, you're not just, you know, trying to figure out markets, although there's not much left of markets, it's mostly robots. But you, as an investor trying to mind your own business or build wealth or expand your portfolio, may get caught in the crossfire of a financial war. So you have to take that into account in your portfolio allocations and risk management.
As you talk about this, you bring up an interesting point, not only today, but in your book, because most citizens, Jim, think of war in terms of military terms. They think of what we just saw last weekend, drone attacks, cruise missiles. When you were working with the CIA, there was also, you played a role with something called CFIUS. I wonder if you might explain. It was in place, then it went away, and then it's come back under Trump. Tell our listeners what this is.
Sure. When you say CFIUS, most people ask you, does it itch or burn? but it's an acronym. It stands for Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. It's authorized by statute. It's an interagency committee, so a little bit unwieldy, but the members include you know, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Commerce, and a few others, U.S. Trade Representative. So it's an interagency group, but it's housed in the Treasury. So the Treasury really acts as the leader of it. And it is a law backed up by a committee and a process that looks at the national security implications when a foreign investor buys a U.S. target company. Now, any acquisition gets reviewed from multiple directions. You've got antitrust review, so-called Hart-Scott-Rodino. You've got, you know, your basic purchase and sale agreement. You might have to clear it with the SEC or the FTC if it involves certain aspects of commerce, or, you know, if it's an airline, the FAA, and if it's telecommunications, you know, different agencies. So you have to jump through a lot of agency hoops. Well, this is one hoop that doesn't primarily have to do with economics. It has to do with national security. And the simplest way to think about it, just take a simple chart, you know, like a matrix with a vertical y-axis and a horizontal x-axis. And your buyers fall into two categories, friends and enemies. So the UK would be a friendly buyer, Canada would be a friendly buyer, Russia would be a hostile buyer, China would be a hostile buyer. So that's one part of the matrix. The other part of the matrix, the other axis, is the target critical infrastructure or not? So if maybe Russia is the buyer, but if they're buying, you know, Ben and Jerry's ice cream who cares? That's not a threat to national security. If you're buying Verizon, forget it. Go away. You can't have that company. You can't touch that company. So the way we thought about it is the buyer friendly or hostile, and is the target sensitive or not? Well, there would be one quadrant where you would have a hostile buyer of a sensitive target. That was the no zone. That was always a no. Again, friendly buyer of a non-sensitive target, yeah, come on in, buy the ice cream company. Well, to make those decisions, the Treasury outsourced the intelligence gathering to the intelligence community, which makes sense. So the CIA didn't have yes or no authority over a deal. They couldn't. That was up to the Treasury and the rest of CFIUS. But they would do the intelligence work to see if there was anything, going on behind the scenes, and report in, and then that would obviously be a powerful input, could influence the outcome, but it wasn't yes or no. So after the Dubai ports fiasco in 2006, when CFIUS greenlighted a deal, basically a Dubai World was buying the major port operator in the United States with operations in seven or eight major ports, I think Baltimore, Miami, New Orleans. I mean, these were all very important port operations. And that was green-lighted. And then Senator Schumer and Senator, at the time, Clinton, Hillary Clinton, stood up and started screaming, you know, you're selling our critical infrastructure to, you know, Arab enemies, et cetera, which was kind of a racist comment because the UAE is a very, very good friend of the United States. I mean, they happen to be Arabs, but so what? They were good allies and have always supported the United States in the Persian Gulf. But that deal blew up in George Bush's face, and they ended up not going ahead as they originally agreed, but it was just a political football. Well, the intelligence community was a little bit in shock. They were like, wait a second, we did everything right. We checked this out. We report to CFIUS, and the deal blows up in our face. It was obviously an embarrassment for the White House and for the intelligence community. So I was asked by the National Intelligence Officer for Military Affairs to form a group. I needed to recruit the people, form the group, and help run it to give us some outside voices. And I did. I got an investment banker, a hedge fund guy, a lawyer, some think tank people, a Middle East expert, a China expert, and so forth. Recruited all these people, put them all together. I called it the Dirty Dozen. There were about 12 of us, and we operated for years as a supplement to what the intelligence community was doing on their own to vet these deals. And we did a great job. We got tons of compliments on this. We were ahead of the curve. You know, at the time we formed it, the big concern was computers and telecommunication because, you know, China had just bought the ThinkPad from IBM through a company called Lenovo. But we said, you know, your next battle space is going to be financial services. And that turned out to be prescient as the 2008 financial crisis unfolded, because at least in the initial stages, Secretary Paulson had to turn to Arabs and Singapore and Abu Dhabi and Kuwait and others, and ultimately South Korea, to bail out the U.S. banks. And we were, as I say, ahead of the curve on all those deals. And if you notice, all those deals stayed below 10%. So they put money in, but they didn't really get control. And that was one of our recommendations. But the deal that did not come to our attention, which should have, because it was the deal, or it was the type of deal that we were formed to think about and look at, was Uranium One, where, you know, it was a long, complicated set of transactions. I describe it in my book. There was another book by a very good writer who covered this in depth, and I used some of his work and had some of my own. But the point, this never should have happened. How did a large portion of U.S. uranium reserves end up in the hands of the Russians? That would seem to fit squarely in this category I described of a hostile buyer of a sensitive area. How did that deal ever get approved? And it never came to our attention. This was not one of the deals we were shown. If we had been shown, it would have flunked our test. But it was because Hillary Clinton, in her capacity as Secretary of State, as a member of CFIUS, just rammed it through. And it was kept away from scrutiny by people who might have opposed it. So it was a political operation. But as I say, I talk about this in the book from the insider's perspective, as someone who sat on one of the important committees in the world of CFIUS.
I want to go back to deficits for a minute, because recently we just, as we mentioned earlier, we hit this $1 trillion deficit, and going forward, we're going to be at $1 trillion deficits. Hard to believe what happens in a recession. You talk about America's new debt issue, and the only way to get rid of it is, number one, we default on it, as some countries we've seen do, Russia, Argentina. Second is inflation. Third is, you know, maybe we sell assets to pay it off. An IMF bailout or a combination, which in your opinion is more likely?
Well, in the U.S., that's easier to predict. By the way, Jim, I just want to just be fair to the other author. It's Peter Schweitzer, who wrote the book on Uranium One. And that's, again, I cover it in my book from Inside CFIUS. But if you want a really good exposition on that, Peter Schweitzer's book does that in depth. But getting back to your question, so the research of Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, and I mentioned this earlier, shows that when you get past 90% debt to GDP ratio, you cannot borrow your way out of the debt trap, because debt, far from being a stimulus, it actually becomes a headwind to growth. So the more you borrow, the slower you grow and the worse it gets. So you can't borrow your way out of it. Now, what are the ways out of that kind of excessive debt? Well, growth is one, but I just eliminated growth because the debt is too high to grow. You got to get the debt down, and that requires some austerity and heavy lifting and things that the Congress and the White House don't seem prepared to do at the moment. The other way out is, and you can't tax your way out of it, because that's also a headwind to growth. You can default on the debt, but there's no reason for the U.S. to default, because the debt is denominated in a currency that we print. Now, if you're Argentina or Turkey and you have dollar-denominated debt, but you can't print dollars, which they can't, and unless you can get a loan from the IMF, you actually can't pay that debt. So you have to default because you can't print the dollars. But the U.S. can print the dollars, so there's no reason for us to default. So if you can't grow your way out of it, if you can't borrow your way out of it, if there's no reason to default because you can print the money, what's the other way out? Well, the answer is inflation. It reduces the real value of the debt. In other words, you would still owe just as much money, but if I turn to China and say, hey, you know, here's your $1 trillion, you know, good luck buying a loaf of bread, because I demolished the value of the currency, that is the classic way out. That's the American way. It's been used many other times, many other places. The problem is, and I always say it's a sad day when a central bank wants inflation and can't get it. The Fed would like to have more inflation. Think about that. Anyone who lived through the 70s and the early 80s, and then a 30-year period when there was practically no inflation, after a 10-year period when there was borderline hyperinflation, to hear a central bank say, we want more inflation, is a little bit, you know, jarring, but they do. But the problem is they can't get it. And here's where, you know, you sort of have to go back to Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman said, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. That's one of his most famous quotes. Inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomena. That is exactly wrong. It's not a monetary phenomena. It's a psychological phenomena. In other words, inflation comes from a combination of two things. Money supply, yes, that is one of the inputs. But the other one is velocity. Velocity is just a fancy word for the turnover of money. You know, I say, I go to a restaurant and I tip the waitress, and then she takes a taxi home and tips the taxi driver, and the taxi driver takes the tip and buys some gasoline. Well, in that example, my dollar had velocity of 3, because you had the waitress tip, the taxi tip, and the gasoline purchase. So the dollar turned over 3 times, so it has velocity of 3. But what if I stay home, watch TV, and don't spend any money? My money has velocity of 0. And I remind people, $4 trillion times 0 is 0, meaning it doesn't matter how much money you print. If you don't have velocity, you don't have an economy. You don't have even nominal growth. Well, guess what? Velocity has been dropping like a stone for 25 years, not since 2008. This started in 1997, not quite 25 years, a little over 20 years. But velocity has been dropping radically over 20 years. So all the money printing that the Fed has done is simply to stay even. We haven't had inflation at all. What we've had to do is offset the decline in velocity. And velocity is psychological. It depends how you feel, how I feel, how, you know, all the listeners feel. Do you feel like borrowing money, spending money, drinks on me, buy this, buy that, last of the big spenders? Or do you feel like deleveraging, not borrowing money, increasing your savings, hoarding your cash, and not spending? Well, on balance, Americans are more the latter than the former. They are more determined to deleverage, spend less, and actually hoard money, is a technical term, than they are to borrow and spend like crazy. Well, as long as that's true, you're not going to get the inflation. You can print all the money you want, but the transmission mechanism is broke down. The transmission mechanism by which the money that's printed gets to the banks, gets to the borrowers, gets invested, gets spent, increases velocity, et cetera. That's broken. And by the way, the last time it was this broken was the early 1930s during the Great Depression. So did the Fed print $4 trillion? Yes. But it was barely enough to keep even with the decline in velocity. And so the real solution to the problem is not money printing. That's easy. The solution is, how do you change the psychology? How do you change expectations? How do you get people into a mood or a mode where they do want to borrow and spend more? Well, that's hard because they were so badly burned in the 2000 dot-com crash and the 2008 mortgage crash, followed by a stock market crash and the worst recession since the Great Depression. And I would argue we're in a depression. That's a separate discussion. This could be intergenerational. You know, everyone knows the stock market crashed in 1929. A lot of other markets crashed with it, real estate and so forth. Well, guess when commercial real estate values in New York recovered the level they reached in 1929? They recovered it in 1954. It took 25 years for commercial real estate to regain the level it reached in 1929. That's what I mean by intergenerational. So it's not going to be easy to get people to go back to where they were in the 1970s or even, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s. It's going to take something much more radical. Well, there is an answer. There is a way to change psychology. There is a way to change expectations. It's been done twice by two presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Richard Nixon. And the answer is devalue the dollar against gold. So that's what I see coming, not right away. Nobody wants to do it. But if you look at history and you understand the psychological aspects of this, and you say, well, how can I change the inflation expectations of the entire country all at once? Well, you can't do it by money printing, but you can do it by raising the value of gold by a factor of 2 or 5 or 10.
Well, I want to point out, for those studying history, that's exactly what Roosevelt did in 1933.
That's right. That the early 1930s were the longest period of sustained deflation in U.S. history, but the price of gold, the dollar price of gold, went up 75%. So how does gold go up 75% in a period of deflation? Well, the answer is you make it happen. The government makes it happen. The government dictated, by market manipulation and other policy means, that the price of gold should go up. But and Roosevelt wasn't much of an economist, but he was willing to try almost anything. And he did have a kind of a quirky, vague economic advisor that he listened to, who was a commodity expert. And this advisor said, well, Mr. President, if you raise the price of gold, that doesn't sit in isolation. The price of everything else will go up. And that's what happened. In 1933, middle of the Great Depression, 1933 was one of the best years ever for the stock market, because not only did gold go up, but, you know, wheat, copper, oil, everything else went up because gold went up nominally, but gold didn't really go up. What happened was the dollar went down, and that's inflation on demand. Nixon thought he was doing something else. I don't think he was doing it quite as deliberately as FDR, but he stumbled onto the same result, which is between 1971 and 1980, the price of gold went up 2,000% from $35 an ounce to $800 an ounce. Well, that's what people say. You know, yeah, that is what happened. Those are the numbers. But when you say the price of gold went up 2,000%, what you're really saying was that the value of the dollar went down by 90%. You know, what Nixon really did was devalue the dollar, and that's what FDR did. And that's what you have to do to get inflation. But how do you do that in a world of floating exchange rates? You know, at least Roosevelt and Nixon had fixed exchange rates, so you had something to devalue against. And you were on a gold standard. It might have been a messed up kind of gold standard, but it was still a gold standard. So they had a benchmark, specifically gold, which they could use to devalue the dollar. But how do you do that in a world where gold does not have a monetary role and exchange rates are already floating? Well, you can't do it unless you go back to gold and devalue against gold, which means the price of gold goes way up.
I want to talk about something we've covered here on the show and the role this might play in this crisis that you see coming. And that's the role of indexing and algo trading. I mean, people are infatuated by the stock market. We're at record levels. And I want to get to interest rates here shortly because we've seen, what is it, $17 trillion of negative global debt. And I saw something last month, Jim, where corporations were issuing debt at negative interest rates. I've never seen that in my entire career. But the thing that strikes me about this, the smartest guys I know, the Ray Dalios, the Paul Tudor Jones, the guys that have been very successful, they all own gold.
Well, they do. What's changed really is that they're talking about it now, and they have it in their funds. Now, I lived in Darien, Connecticut for about 35 years. It's one town over from Greenwich, Connecticut, and I worked in Greenwich for decades, and it's kind of, you know, ground zero for hedge funds. At least it was. Connecticut has its problems these days, let's put it that way. But, you know, so you just know a certain number of billionaires. They're your neighbors and they're around or they work in the same firm or whatever. And a lot of the billionaires were hedge fund managers. So in their funds, they might trade stocks or bonds or commodities or whatever. But in their personal accounts, which they don't talk about, I never met one who didn't have gold and a lot of it. So, they don't want to talk about it or shout it from the rooftops, but they have gold. And what's different is that now Ray Dalio and others are talking about it openly. They're saying, yeah, you got to have some gold. And we have it in our fund, not just in my in your personal portfolio, but in the fund itself. So that's a change in the psychology and the openness about it. But of course they should for, you know, the reasons we've been discussing, which is, inflation is the only way out of this debt crisis. And again, it's not on the horizon today, but it will come because it has to come because it's the only way out of the, it's the only way to escape the room, so to speak. So, you do see that. There's a reason for it, you know, which is what we've been discussing. And the problem is that a lot of gold that people own or say they own is they're actually securities, you know, gold. ETF is not gold. It's a security. It trades on the New York Stock Exchange. A gold futures contract is not gold. It's a futures contract. It trades on the COMEX. Even if you use a London Bullion Market Association forward agreement with JP Morgan, that's not gold. It's a contract. It's a paper contract. And the point is that all of those contracts, futures, options, ETFs, they can all be terminated. I'm enough of a geek that I not only read contracts and have throughout my career, but I've read the rule books of all the major exchanges. And what people don't realize is every stock or commodity exchange in the rule book has a rule that says they can change the rules. And so, you know, when the Hunt brothers were whining in the early 80s about, you know, the government changing the rules in the silver market, well, too bad. I mean, you should have read the rule book because it says they can do that. And the same is true in gold. So if you ever had sort of a gold panic, gold buying panic, and people with gold futures say, well, I'm not rolling it over, I'm not terminating it, give me the gold. The COMEX would terminate those contracts. There's not enough gold to deliver to the longs in gold futures, not even close. And they tell you that. They say, we are not a source of supply. We're here for hedging. You can be a speculator. That's okay. But don't ever look to us for physical gold. We have a little bit just to keep everybody honest and in bounds and create some linkage between physical gold and the gold futures. But don't turn to us for gold because we don't have it. Well, so what are they going to do? Well, if everyone puts in notice of delivery, they're going to terminate the agreements. They won't steal your money. They'll send you a check for yesterday's closing price. But you're like, hey, wait, I don't want yesterday's closing price. I want today's, tomorrow's, the next day. That's why I bought this gold future. They're going to say, too bad. You're terminated. They've got termination clauses, rule change clauses, force majeure. There are lots of ways of doing it. And they're just going to send you a check, but it's not what you want. You wanted the forward protection, and you don't have it anymore. If you want to trade a gold ETF for day-to-day price exposure, you know, yeah, that's okay. But don't think of it as gold in the end game where, you know, gold's going up $100 or $200 per ounce per day with no end in sight. That's when you're really going to want your gold. You're not going to be able to get it physically, and those contracts are not going to be worth very much. But yeah, that is a significant change in thinking about it. And, you know, as far as the passive investing is concerned, the way I describe it to people, you know, I like to use metaphors, but they're the good metaphors if they have a little science behind them. You know, if a mosquito lands on the back of an elephant, what happens? Well, the mosquito gets a good meal and the elephant doesn't notice. But if a million mosquitoes land on the back of an elephant, the elephant dies. In other words, you can't just look at the benefits of something, in this case to the mosquito. You have to look at the scale and what else is going on. And when passive investing, you know, was invented in the 1970s, you know, Jack Bogle, the Vanguard Fund and all that, they had a very simple pitch. They said, look, you can't beat the market. That's not a true statement, by the way. You can beat the market, but it is extremely hard, and most managers don't. So I'll give them credit for that. But just as a footnote, you can beat the market if you have the right models, which most people do not. But they said, you can't beat the market. Why try? Stocks go up over time. They have ups and downs, but if you're buy and hold and hang in there, you'll do very well. And so why don't you invest in this index fund? Our fees are very low. We ride the market. You'll come out ahead. You know, you can do other things. You don't have to think about stocks. Well, that was like one mosquito. It actually was true and it worked. The problem today is we are now at the point where the passive investors are dominating, are far greater than the active investors. The mosquitoes are swarming on the back of the elephant. Every passive investor is a parasite on the body of an active investor. What do active investors do? They do fundamental research. They take risks. They engage in price discovery. When everyone else wants to sell, they buy. When everyone else wants to buy, they sell. In other words, they're the other side of the market. So passive investing has grown enormously and has been successful on its own terms, but it has done so by being a parasite on the body of the active investors. What happens when there are no more active investors and the market starts to go down? It goes down sharply. What happens? Well, investors in the passive funds, they get spooked. They call up and say, give me cash, give me cash. Well, so how does a passive fund, an index fund, get you cash if you're a shareholder? Well, they have to sell stocks. But the market's already going down. So what are they doing? They're selling stocks into a declining market. That makes the market go down faster. In the old days, the active investor would step up and say, ah, I see a bargain, I'm a buyer. But if you have no more active investors, the market goes no bid and it goes straight down. And that's the problem. We haven't had that happen yet because we've never had quite so many passive investors dominating the market, but we do now. So the next time the market goes down sharply, you're going to find that there's no bottom because the active investors have died and gone away.
Yeah, that's interesting because we're doing this interview on a Thursday, and Wednesday's Wall Street Journal had an article, Jim, for the first time in history, these index funds now clearly outnumber active investors. So we're on this track you're talking about. I want to move on to a conclusion in your book. How do you envision the next crisis unfolding? And in the next crisis and financial panic that will ensue, you contend no one will be in charge. The solutions proposed will be more ad hoc rather than thoughtful and reasoned. So what does this look like?
Well, I talk about this in my new book in Chapter 8 and in the conclusion, but this is also something I spent some time on in my previous book, The Road to Ruin, where I had a couple chapters on this. But the short answer is, and here you have to kind of go back over the chronology, and everyone's well aware of what happened in 2008. But 10 years earlier, in 1998, we had a global liquidity crisis and a global panic that centered on a Russian default and the hedge fund long-term capital management. And I actually negotiated the bailout of long-term capital management. I was their general counsel, and I had to face off against what I call the 14 families, which were the 14 biggest banks on Wall Street, and their CEOs, and the Treasury was involved, the Fed was involved. And we brought that in for a soft landing, but unless you were there, unless you were involved, most people, or say almost no one, realizes how close that came. We were hours away from closing every major exchange in the world. We were trying to get the deal done late on a Sunday so we could make some announcement prior to the opening of the Japanese markets. And, you know, the Fed was keeping the Fed wire open so the money could move. I mean, just everyone was pulling out every stop to get this done. And we did it. And everyone kind of said, okay, that's over, no big deal, on to the next thing. And then, of course, you had the dot-com crash and the mortgage crisis. But very few people realize how close the markets came to complete closure and complete collapse at that time. But what happened then was Wall Street bailed out a hedge fund. Okay, now flash forward to 2008, what happened? Now it wasn't a hedge fund anymore. It was Wall Street itself that was in distress. Wall Street was collapsing. Bear Stearns fell. Fannie Mae fell. Freddie Mac fell. Lehman Brothers fell. AIG. Morgan Stanley was days away from going out of business, and Goldman Sachs would have been right behind them, and so on. All the dominoes were falling. And then the Fed came in and bailed everything out. And, you know, they guaranteed every money market fund in America. They guaranteed every bank deposit in America, regardless of size. They did $10 trillion worth of currency swaps with the European Central Bank because Europeans needed dollars and the ECB couldn't print them. So the Fed said, here you go. Here's $10 trillion. We'll take your euros in exchange, et cetera. Zero interest rates, quantitative easing. I mean, on and on and on. But that's what it took to avoid a similar sequential collapse. Well, so 98, the Wall Street bails out a hedge fund. 2008, the central banks bail out Wall Street. Who's going to bail out the central banks? You haven't solved the problem. You've just moved it upstairs. Well, now you're in the penthouse. There's only one clean balance sheet left in the world, which is the IMF. But and I spoke to the head of the IMF about this privately, and the internal politics are not to be believed, and it moves slowly at best, and sometimes not at all. So that's not a solution. It'll come, but that's not a solution you want to really rely on. So the point being, what will they do if importantly the Fed, but no reason to pick on the Fed because the same is true for the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, ECB, you know, People's Bank of China, and others. They have never normalized their balance sheets. Yeah, I mean, the Fed took the M0 base money from $800 billion to $4 trillion between 2008 and 2014, but they never got back down to $800 billion. They didn't even get down to $3 trillion. They're still not too far from $4 trillion today. So they've never been able to normalize their balance sheet. They've never been able to normalize interest rates. Jay Powell threw in the towel on interest rates last December, and he threw in the towel on balance sheet reduction at the end of July. So they're going back to, you know, rate cutting and keeping the balance sheet constant, and they're on their way back to zero rates, QE, and other extraordinary means. So they never got back to normal. So what happens when the next crisis comes? What are they going to do? Go to $5 trillion, $6 trillion, $7 trillion? Well, the modern monetary theorists would say no problem, but they're wrong. It's not a legal issue. It's a confidence issue. There's an invisible psychological boundary. And once you cross it, people lose confidence in the dollar itself. So that's what we're facing. One way around that, of course, is to have a decent allocation to physical gold because it's, you know, it's non-digital. You can't hack it. You can't erase it. If you have safe custody of it outside the banking system, it's not even something that can be frozen by the government. So that plus, you know, other hard assets, which we mentioned, you know, land, gold, silver, energy, you know, et cetera, some private equity, things that are not reliant on liquidity to retain value. Those will be how you preserve wealth.
As we conclude, this is the latest of a quartet of books. This is called Aftermath. I would recommend our listeners read your previous three books because you have this gift of taking something complicated. And as you said, you act as a translator. You make it understandable. What about just reading this for somebody that doesn't have time to read four books? Would you recommend they read Aftermath to get a good handle? Because this really is sort of a conclusion of your thesis.
Yeah, I would recommend it, Jim, because the books all stand on their own and they all have their unique facet of the problem. But it's also cumulative. So as I write new books, I tend to take the stuff in the previous books and bring it along with me.
Jim, I want to thank you for taking so much time and elucidating so many of the issues that have been very complex that are very hard to understand. It's been a real pleasure, and thanks for joining us on the program.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any company companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.